Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Wow, happy year of the snake, everybody. Yes, it's a Lunar New Year. And here in the northeast of the United States, North America, we have been socked with a big snowstorm. So, if you are feeling cabin fever, if you'd like to talk to somebody, if you haven't been out of the house in 48 hours, but your phone is working, call us at 718-54... No, ha, ha, ha. Joe, what's our number here?
It would be 718-497-2128.
Very good. 497-2128, area code 718. Today I wanted to have back the design writer and critic Alexander Lang, whose most recent work is Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities, published by Princeton Architectural Press in 2012. It's a real nice book. I highly recommend it. I actually bought it.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Welcome back to Burning Down the House. Last time you were a phoner.
Yes. Well, today I made the trek to Bushwick.
Yeah. All the way from another part of Brooklyn?
Yeah, I live in Cobble Hill.
How do you get there from here?
You take the G to the L.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's not so bad.
No, it's fine.
It's like fine. Me taking the 1 to the L. You know, it's just around the corner. Those of us in the five boroughs really are not so bad off. A few miles out of town, though, it's really snow turf. It really, and we're going to talk about cities a little bit, buildings and cities, and it speaks well to the whole notion of urbanism, don't you think?
You mean just the reaction to the storm?
I mean, being in a city
makes it so much easier
absolutely.
To deal with. Yes, yes. I mean, yesterday morning, my son and I took the subway from Brooklyn to Manhattan at 9 in the morning, no problem, even though there had been a blizzard the night before, because the class we'd signed up for wasn't canceled, and I thought, well, we might as well go then.
Yeah, a distance of probably, 20 miles or so, maybe, huh?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, but, you know, it took about an hour, but I also I'm excited to bring my kids up in the city, and I like teaching them that it is perfectly normal to just walk through the snowdrifts to the subway and get on with your life.
That's right.
Yeah.
Instead of everything grinding to a halt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, Alexandra teaches design criticism. Who knew that you could actually learn how to be a design critic? And where is that?
I teach at NYU and also at the School of Visual Arts. NYU, I teach undergraduates, and the School of Visual Arts is an MFA program in design criticism.
Wow.
Yeah.
A master's at... Of design criticism.
A master's of design criticism.
Wow. So the obvious question that I have, how do you teach critical thinking and then critical writing?
Well, when I was putting together my class now about 8 years ago, I started reading all of these books about how to teach writing, just writing in general, and I found them all to be really, really boring because they were talking about writing in general, and that wasn't so interesting. I felt like I needed to be talking about something more specific. So when I was putting together my class, I went back to a lot of the pieces of critical writing that meant a lot to me and made a big difference to me. And I read them over and over and really analyzed them to figure out what they had in common. Uh-huh. And that's basically the way I teach my class. I make the students read a lot of great pieces of criticism, and we talk about it, and then we go and do field trips, and then we do it together.
Yeah. I understand that we might have a caller. Is that true, Joe? Yeah? If so...
Yeah, we should have a caller. Duo, are you on the line?
I am on the phone.
Oh, hi. How excellent. Introduce yourself, caller.
This is Duo Dickinson.
Calling from?
Madison, Connecticut, land of snow.
Aha. Well, we're here with Alexander Lang in the studio. If you were here, you'd be very happy because you cannot see a bit of snow looking out through the windows here at the cozy, warm, wood fire heated garden room of Roberta's restaurant. I really feel sorry for you, but I'm glad that you were able to call in, and I guess you've got phone service at least, and maybe even electricity.
More or less. Sometimes you chop it around a little bit, but if I make an incoherent answer, I'll blame it on the telephone.
Oh, fair enough. We just started talking with Alexandra about how she crafted her courses for teaching design criticism and design writing by looking at good examples. Now, you've done some design writing, Duo.
Yeah, well, I was probably the only 5-year B Arch student at Cornell in the 70s that actually had a minor, and my minor was English, and I actually took a wide variety of English courses. And so really from the time I've graduated, I've written either books for McGraw-Hill or articles for a wide variety of shelter magazines, and recently on a bunch of blogs, including Architecture Boston, and most recently just been signed on to write a series for House magazine, and also to work with the architectural plans website, House Plans, to bring architecture into the world of prefabricated design.
Right. Well, I have a question for both you, Alexandra, and for Duo. And I like to sometimes take the devil's advocate point of view. And in this case, you might say, so what? Who cares? Who cares about criticism? I mean, isn't it all really... Here's the devil's advocate position. Isn't it all really just about what buildings look like?
Well, naturally, I would say not at all. And I think most of the best criticism, I would use Ada Louise Huxtable, who recently died and was a longtime critic for the New York Times and then the Wall Street Journal, as an example of someone who combined talking about what buildings looked like with really a lot of discussion of how they functioned and also how they got there. She was incredibly canny about the politics of building in New York and of real estate development. And as a critic, she stood somewhat outside those power structures and could comment on how things were getting built in New York and how those power structures caused things to be built that didn't really work for most people. So she went way beyond what it looked like, but she felt like what it looked like was also important as part of making a better city, because aesthetics do matter in terms of the overall cityscape.
Now, Duo, I know that you're a practicing architect in addition to being a writer. But your work tends not to be in urban settings, right?
No, it does not. And I can also say that in terms of criticism, the real issue for me comes down to who is your audience. And Ada Louise Huxtable was speaking in often very broad terms, almost philosophic terms, about the meaning of the urban environment and how buildings influence it. And as such, you know, I think she had an unbelievably important role in taking these large-scale decisions out of the star chamber and breaking them down into making it a social act and a cultural and political act versus just an aesthetic act to build things. And the problem that I've had in the last 20 years or so has been that the level of criticism is a very strange word. I just call it writing about architecture. Writing about architecture has devolved from writers that engage themselves in both popular culture as well as architecture itself, and created really books that transcended, or writings that transcended, that little world that we all inhabit. You know, books like From Our House to Bauhaus, and any number of books that Charles Moore and Kent Bloomer wrote those all dealt with architecture with a knowing eye because they understood it, but they also broke it down in a way that the average consumer could relate to it. I find that the vast majority of criticism is either dumbed down to the point where it talks about the most superficial aspects of design, or it's so inside baseball, using the jargon and the phraseology of the academic world, that it is intended for a tiny group of architects and architectural theory people, and it's meaningless to anybody else.
I'm sorry, we were distracted by a fellow waving through the studio window, okay. Who I don't recognize.
I don't recognize him either. No, but Duo was just talking about architecture criticism either being so broad as to be meaningless or so inside baseball as to be meaningless,
right,
I think, in another way.
And before I was distracted, I wanted to say, now, wait a second. Tom Wolfe's from Our House to Bauhaus, which started out as a series in The New Yorker, I thought was wonderful, but I'd already been to architecture school.
Mm.
Well, and I think all of his conclusions are wrong.
Well, it's also it's a bad example because it's a very catty inside baseball book in terms of the intelligentsia. So.
I thought that his conclusion was that the sort of Gropius influenced modern movement was elitist and therefore stupid.
Yeah, that was the bottom line. He did have this wonderful predetermined outcome where there's a conspiracy of the elite to dissociate architecture from the rest of us.
Right, as if there are Illuminati who decide what gets built.
As if architects have any power. But
that's exactly correct.
But B, I mean, I feel like every time I read that book, I get very, very angry because while I may never be able to write as wittily as Tom Wolfe, I think that he totally mischaracterizes a wide swath of modernism. And as history has shown, I think Gropius is maybe less influential than Tom Wolfe made him out to be. So, you know, we'll see in the end. But I would not recommend that book as a starting point for most people in learning about architecture.
Oh, no. absolutely not. No. If you like Tom Wolfe, it's fun.
Yes. But if you like architecture, it's maddening.
Oh, no. It's no more a description of what architecture is really about than Bonfire of the Vanities is about finance.
Mm.
Even though I was working on Wall Street during the period of time that Bonfire is all about, and there were those excesses, I mean, that was a sociological parody. So it gets back to, so what? I mean, why write critically about architecture or the landscape or the contributions to the built landscape? Is it so that the public could be more engaged and actually there might be some kind of dialogue about what's planned?
Well, let me jump in only because I'm hearing about every third word, but I think I get it. I can tell you that the big gap for me, and this is going to be a piece that I've written for Architecture Boston in the next month or so, the big gap for me is that you had books like The Shingle Style by Scully, and you had books like The Place of Houses that were written by Moore and Turnbull and my brain is spacing on the third author, but you had books that were written in plain English, very understandable, that also dealt with the context and realities of how buildings actually get built and aesthetics, where you combine the act of building, the culture it's built in, the mind of the architect, and it becomes kind of a window into a process which is anything but the elitist, glitterati thing that was in From Our House to Bauhaus to Our House. And I find that there's no writing like that out there anymore. I mean, my writing tries to do that, but the truth is, you know, I don't have an academic position, and even though I write for about five blogs and you know, a magazine or two, and have written seven books, you know, you could probably take the number of people that have read my everything I've ever written, and it's about, you know, one tenth of what has read from our house to Bauhaus, from Bauhaus to our house. So my sadness is that words have become dissociated from design, and it really, whether it's Venturi talking about his own work or other people that actually felt free to share it verbally, like Kent Bloomer, who's a real hero of mine, I get the feeling that we really have become, as a social cluster, really a choir just singing in the choir loft with no one listening. And it's just depressing to me, since I've devoted my life both to building and to writing, to be consigned to that level of exposure.
Well, I would say that I agree that words and design have been dissociated, but I'm not as pessimistic about as you are about the future of writing about design and architecture. There was just a really interesting piece on the website Dezine, which is one of these websites that every day publishes 10 new projects, design, architecture, product design, mostly renderings given to them by the architects with their press releases. But they've recently started an opinion section.
Oh, good.
And yes, which is terrific. And Sam Jacob from the British firm FAT wrote a piece about how we were deluged by images, but nobody was being critical about them on one of these websites that is a deluge of images that nobody's being critical about. Now, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for Design Observer where I have a weekly blog called The Vacuum of Enthusiasm, where I took on the broader question of design blogs and made a very similar point that obviously design blogs are being very carefully selected. All of the material on them is being very carefully selected in general. And wouldn't it be more interesting if the people behind those blogs came out and started talking about how they were selecting it, because they are making critical judgments all the time. And
yes.
And even as they talk about critics as being haters, they are functioning as critics. They're just not verbalizing it. And I think there's this whole other dimension to understanding taste, understanding design, understanding architecture that comes through writing. I mean, obviously I would say this, but I really do believe it's true. We need to try to bring these things together. And one of the great things about blogs is that there is an infinite amount of space to do it in. I mean, some of the architecture publications they have been shrinking and shrinking. And one of the first things to go is columnists and critical columns, or they move them online. Or, you know, the Architecture Record book section that I write for is now all online. And at first I thought that was sad. But now I think maybe it's not so bad, because the distribution of things online can be so much greater, so much faster. It's just a matter of figuring out how to get it out there and how to get it linked to on a wider variety of places.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that said about Metropolis's content, that actually most of it's online.
Yeah, yep. Almost the entire magazine is online.
Yep. Plus more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
So I'm still not hearing thought divorced from what's really happening. Let me try a different approach. Do you think it's possible through design writing, through critical design writing, which is not always happy for the people about whose work is being written? And we'll get to, I want to talk about Kimmelman and Foster in a while. Is it possible in this age of media saturation and at the same time a public that's generally illiterate in the arts and especially in architecture to make an effect?
Well, that's actually something I talk about in the introduction to my book. So my book, Writing About Architecture, is based on the class that I teach, and my publisher is generally hoping that it will be course adopted at architecture schools as it has been.
I'm sure it will be, yeah.
As it has been. But I, was also hoping, and this may be utopian of me, that it would reach people who were potential clients or who were people that didn't like what was going on in the planning in their cities. And by reading it and learning the language of criticism, they were could be better able to speak to the people in charge of making design decisions for their urban environment. Because I think a lot of times there's just a real disconnect between what architects are saying and what they're showing and what people who come to community board meetings are saying. And if they were speaking the same language, more change could happen.
Well, I can amplify on that. And there's everything that I write about, well, not everything, but 95% has to do with the house or housing. Mm-hmm. And what is amazing to me and wonderful is that despite the maybe this is causing it, but despite the architects sort of turning away from using the written word as a way to somehow enrich the design process, which it really was the case with Charles Moore and Robert Venturi, you know, it's just there, you can read it, you can see it, it's there. It cross-pollinated, the words cross-pollinated with the designs, and it became more exciting and interesting and evolutionary. What is wonderful is that because of the Internet, the clients that I have, and we have a huge diversity of clients from the poorest of the poor to extremely wealthy people, by and large, everyone knows more now than the clients did 20 years ago, pretty much about everything to do with houses anyway, because there's been so much house media. Mm-hmm. What I do find sad, and it really is sad, is that there is the desire in many critics' minds to basically write in a way for other critics or for other academic venues that will essentially say, I am the smartest person in the room, and I am looking at this from some empirical world which has really no desire to actually talk about the essential realities of context or budget or technology or any of the things which they assume to be boring because they're bored with it. When if you have somebody who is as experienced dealing with technology, who is also engaged in academia, as both, you know, Moore and Venturi were, you could actually have insights and connections in a way that isn't opaque, that actually makes the writing better.
I'd like to interrupt you because I mean you're no personal offense, and I know that you know that I mean no personal offense. You say there are those who. Could you give us some examples? I mean, who writes that way or has written that way?
Mm-hmm.
Could we have an example?
Oh, could you repeat that, because it dropped out again?
Okay, so you speak somewhat in generalizations about certain writers who don't write about the intricacies because it's boring, but only writes... That write gloss.
Right.
Do you have a writer or two in mind who are examples of the kind of writing that you don't endorse?
Well, Kimmelman for The Times.
You don't...
Who is really the art critic for The Times.
You don't endorse Kimmelman?
No. I find that he writes in ways that really do kind of put me off. And I do think that although some of the superficial insights are great, he does write about architecture much more like an art critic than an architect would write about it. And so I think that there are some very simple ways that he makes comparisons to other buildings, between buildings that are functionally impossible, where he'll talk about one building A and building Z, and building A is one thing and building Z is another, and he says, why can't building A be more like building Z? And I do find his writing kind of superficial. Now, that having been said, you know, that Goldberger to me also seems superficial, but I will say that Goldberger seemed to have a sense that he would actually talk to architects and really be part of that, of the architectural world, and try to understand their mind. What I do find interesting is that you either have people that are in school with architecture degrees writing about architects from an academic perspective, an aesthetic perspective, or you've got writers who are not architects writing about architects as if they were, and this is probably because they want to, many of them want to be, as if they were fashion designers or as if they were product fabricators, really judging the product and not how the product is made. in both ways, the dissociation from buildings from how they're made as opposed to what they are is a missing link, which is now, you know, screaming in the writing that I read.
Okay, now it's Alexandra's turn.
Huh. Yes.
I feel like as somebody who has a BA in architecture, so I don't really count as an architect, but writing about architecture. Yes, I have a BA.
Oh, good.
And I feel that I do have insight into buildings. So I guess I never put it down to qualifications or specific qualifications, how a particular writer looks at architecture. Like, I mean, I don't like it when people say only graphic designers should write about graphic design. Only architects should write about architecture.
Otherwise, terrible. Yeah, I agree.
Otherwise, you can't have enough insight. I actually think criticism is incredibly personal. Right. And even just the way you talked about Michael Kimmelman's writing is very personal. I mean, everyone goes about it in an idiosyncratic way, and so I think it's hard to generalize. But I actually think, and I have to say, I don't really read much academic criticism anymore at all. I'm personally much more interested in making architecture more a part of a broader cultural dialogue.
Well, that's good, because the the attempts at architectural criticism that you might read in the Harvard Design School journal that comes out a couple times a year is so dense and so twisted that I can't understand what they're trying to say. And I think I'm a pretty highly placed consumer of architectural theoretical thought because I don't just practice, but I spend a lot of time in research. And it's bullshit. You know, I find it highly offensive, actually, that they put so much effort into publishing some of this stuff. But, well, let's get into specifics. Kimmelman wrote in the Times recently a piece about Norman Foster's scheme for bringing a circulating library back into the main research library location of the New York Public Library, the Grand Building by Carrere and Hastings at 42nd Street, you know, with the two lions, Patience and Fortitude, out in front. And I thought that Kimmelman's critique was actually quite refreshing, because he called it for what it was, a Las Vegas-style shopping mall inserted into this grand neoclassic building.
Right.
And also, by the way, there were structural concerns about how the heck they were going to do it. And he actually spoke to somebody on the structural engineering team, mm-hmm, who said, yeah, you're right. The structure is the stacks back there. Right. And then Foster, and I don't know if you've read Foster's response.
Oh, yeah, I read it.
You know, Foster was highly indignant, as if, how dare you? How dare you?
He said, I think the quote is, he said it was offensive and premature. Yeah. Which, I mean, really, Norman Foster should have a thicker skin at this point.
You should think.
And I admire architects, and I've known a few of them that I've written critically about, and they call me up and they say, let's come in and talk about it, because they understand that it's a dialogue and this is interesting. And I feel like if they call me, they actually respect what I have to say, even if they have disagree. So Foster's response was completely immature. And really, I mean, how can writing critically in the New York Times about what might happen to the New York Public Library ever be premature? I mean, now is the time when a critic can actually affect something.
Of course.
And unfortunately, it often seems that it's only critics affiliated with important institutions like the New York Times that can have an effect on public policy. So, I mean, if now, not now, when? Right. Well, the whole thing was just crazy.
Or in other words, don't send us your first draft if you think that it's not baked yet.
Right.
Because we're going to
do... And frankly... It did seem like a first draft. I mean, it was incredibly generic. The renderings were incredibly generic. Norman Foster in quotations, and I don't understand why that should be at all.
Well,
at
can
all.
I? Can I?
Oh, sure.
Can I just make one criticism of his criticism, which was glaring to me when I read the piece, which was he said this, and a lot of it seemed to be true. A lot of it seemed to be the there was the aspect there wasn't much there that you could even see as being. There wasn't a sentence that said I could understand why he took this approach for X, Y, and Z. He just basically dismissed it as a suburban mall with wasted space. And
I don't think he needed to say that because I can't see why they decided to do that either.
Well, you could even make the case, and you could make the very superficial case that there, you can venerate an antique building by making a contrasting crystalline form. You could just say that in passing and then go on to trash it. He didn't do that. The other thing is that he also didn't say, and maybe he tried to do, but he didn't say he tried to do it, was he didn't actually talk to the architect. And I think that when you want to write a piece that's this, and I do applaud all the different ways that he sort of got into how the decisions were made and what the grand plan was, and I thought that was excellent. What I do miss is when a piece, and I think this was done more in the past, and I have nothing to base that other than my feeble 57-year-old memory, I do remember when architects were interviewed before the criticism was done, and you'd actually hear the words of the architect in the piece that ended up being either positive or negative or whatever, but you'd hear the words of the designer in the piece.
Yes, but I will defend Kimmelman because I do not know of a project where Lord Foster actually granted an interview before it was done.
I
mean,
I agree.
Yeah, I mean,
and I don't know if I mean, actually, just returning to Ada Louise Huxtable, she said to me once that when she was working at the Times as a critic, the Times wouldn't let her write a review of a project until it had been reported on. But because at that time they didn't have a separate architectural reporter, she would write a reported article, journalism, ostensibly neutral about a project. And then on Sunday or something, she would write her analysis of the project. And I think that the architect's words are better placed in the reportage than in the critical piece. I mean, I base this partially on, I teach this class on criticism, and I often ask the architects to give us tours of the projects. And several times after this happened, all the students would just be sort of so snowed by the glamour of meeting the real architect who took them around and told them everything that they would just regurgitate back everything the architect said about their building. So now we do the tours and I say to them afterward, yes, he's very charming, blah, he or she, but it's usually he's very charming, blah, 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 but you don't have to believe a word that he says. Like, use your eyes, use your critical judgment, because
yes,
he says it works this way. What do you think? Did you trip on the steps? And, a whole litany of, sort of mundanities.
You took them to the new museum.
No, I didn't. Actually, I checked them. Where were the steps? Oh, we did the new entrance to Parsons, which has all these crazy ramps. And then most recently, we did the East River waterfront by Shop.
Yeah.
I give them a major warning, and I feel like all of us as critics, as writers, there is this Stockholm syndrome once you've met the architect that if they're very charming, you can sort of start to believe them.
That's absolutely true. A lot of firms trade on a legend. I mean, it's almost like spycraft, and they develop a legend that this partner knows everything. Let's just hypothetically say that the senior partner knows everything about sustainable building, and the junior partner is absolutely brilliant and a fantastic design talent, and that's all they see. Mm-hmm. That because that's the legend, because no one's coming in saying, I don't know if this is true. The prospective clients already have the legend, and they're not critically appraising what's being presented to them with any kind of filter, which is where design criticism might have a role.
Right. And when I'm reporting on a project, generally for a more reported piece rather than criticism, I always say, I'm happy to talk to the project architect, no matter how junior, because he or she knows what actually happened and yep. knows the ins and outs much better typically than the senior partner. And I don't, you know, I don't care about having that name in my article necessarily. I mean, it depends. Some, you know, some editors insist on it. But for my information, it's much easier for me to talk to the project architect. They're often more my age. Just for a variety of reasons, it just goes better and I get more out of it.
And that in that model, architectural record used to be really good in terms of reporting because they would actually interview people who worked right. on a project about what were the intentions yep. and yep. how is the building supposed to work. Joe, could we have a little, I don't know, snow trucker music for a couple minutes so we could just catch our breaths and reframe our thoughts and carry on?
This song is called Broke Down by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking about design criticism. In studio, we have Alexandra Lang, who teaches Decrit in New York City. She is the author of Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities, published by Princeton Architectural Press, 2012, and also our call-in guest, architect and writer Duo Dickinson. During our little break, Alexandra was reminding me of her invitation. And Duo, do stay on. You might find this interesting. Alexandra has been invited to go and talk about design criticism in the land down under. Tell us about that.
Yes, I am going to Australia for a week at the beginning of March, and I am going to be on a series of public panels about architecture criticism in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane. So if you have any Australian listeners, I hope they will attend the panels.
I hope so too.
Yeah, but I'm rather fascinated that architecture culture in Australia is really so interested in criticism at the moment, mm-hmm. and thinking about it. And I'm really looking forward, A, to going to Australia, where I've never been before, seeing the Sydney Opera House, among other buildings, and talking about it and kind of learning from the other people while bringing my own experience.
Well, when you get down to Melbourne, I hope that Triple R Radio in Melbourne, the architects, ask you to come on and talk about your architectural criticism, because they talk a mile a minute in their Melbourne accent, and they are Antipodean competition with burning down the house here in New York.
Well, that would be fun, but you know, you just reminded me of one of my many neuroses about this trip, which is that people will get up and ask questions at the Q&As, and I won't be able to understand their accent. So.
Yeah. Alexandra, when you're saying that architectural criticism is really important, and well, you just have to say, well, I'm kind of jet-lagged, you know? Could you speak a little more slowly?
Yeah.
Well, perhaps you could speak in received pronunciation. Anyway, that's really great.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm really excited.
Oh. Well, you'll have to come back and tell us, you know, what happened, or you'll have to write about it in Design Observer.
Oh, I will be blogging, as I usually do. And you actually reminded me, I would be remiss if I did not say that the program that I teach in at the School of Visual Arts, which is the MFA in Design Criticism, is currently accepting applications for the fall. And they also have a summer intensive program in June, which is basically 2 weeks of design writing boot camp, which is intended for professionals who just want to take a break and think about their writing for 2 weeks and kind of step it up a level. That it'll be the second annual design writing intensive, and it went really well last summer. So I would highly recommend it if any listeners are thinking about getting into design writing.
Excellent. Alexandra, yeah. I would be remiss not to say that I'm available to be a visiting critic or an adjunct professor if there's any position there.
Okay. I will let my boss know.
Good, because I have ideas, I'm fair-minded, and I can talk.
Me too, by the way.
And also Duo.
You know, it's funny, the program
Well, you know, we both come to the class to get passed for one person, we just split it.
That would be great.
The funny thing is that there are a number of us that teach in the program that really started, and some still are, architecture critics. But by and large, the students who come to the program are not there, don't have an architecture background and are not interested in writing about architecture per se.
Really?
So I've tweaked my class over the years. I mean, the principles are the same, but to give them more options for writing about environmental graphics, or this last semester there was an option to write about apps or digital space, which has been good for me to try to stretch a little bit.
But what about furniture?
They could write about furniture. That hasn't come up. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago about coffee makers, which was my industrial design criticism that I'm actually planning to revisit, because I finally found my ideal coffee maker, and it was made in 1974. So
I wrote a piece about eyeglasses once.
Oh, yeah. See, I love glasses. I have glasses. I should look that up.
Well, I should, Alexandra, I should introduce you to Rich Thrush. Mm-hmm. He's the design director for DAZ, and they design most of the ordinary stuff that you would see if you went through a Walmart. The bug zappers.
Interesting.
Because you're a mother, I'm sure that you have electronic medical things, you know, like
yes.
thermometers and things. They actually design those things. From a point of view of how do they work?
We have had a lot of trouble with our electronic thermometer, so I would like to talk to
him. I can introduce you to him.
Another blog post.
Another guest who's been on the program was Daniela Ohad Smith, who has a design blog. Mm-hmm. You know about her?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And I guess she's teaching.
Yeah, actually, I think she has taught at the SVA program. But, you know, it's a bunch of adjuncts, so we all pass in the night and don't necessarily ever meet each other.
Right. And I just recently discovered in my own research that Patrick Schumacher, Zaha Hadid's partner, has described the formation of furniture as actually making space within parametric structures, which I thought was really funny that he would actually admit, and I don't think that he was understanding what he was saying when he was saying it. And this was at some presentation that he made at the Biennale in Venice a few years ago, that the parametricists, and for those of you who are interested, lay listeners, shall we say, parametrics is an approach to making architectural form by using computer-generated shapes, which ends up in buildings that look like tormented fish or a car. Who was the artist who used to make sculptures out of crushed-up auto bodies?
John Chamberlain.
Right, exactly. That's parametricism.
But I like John Chamberlain, but I don't like parametricism.
Oh, I don't. I'm with you. Are you still there? Have you fallen off the chair, Duo? I guess we lost Duo. We've been... this is, in case you just logged in or you are catching this podcast on the random feed from Heritage Radio Network, we're talking with Alexandra Lang about design criticism. You know, why do it? And where design criticism might possibly go. Now, one thing that I wanted to talk with you about, Alexandra, was I know that your husband is an architect and you live in a house and your house project was in Dwell.
Yes.
Question was, which I attempted last time you were a guest, which you gave me sort of an evasive answer to, but I just had to come back to it. Why? Why is everybody in a Dwell house barefoot?
That's very funny because when my house was in Dwell, it was during the heyday of the Tumblr blog Unhappy Hipsters, which I don't know if you're familiar with. But
absolutely.
Basically, it existed to make fun of the photos of people in Dwell.
Yes.
So when my house was in Dwell, I thought, okay, what's going to happen, you know, with how will I appear on Unhappy Hipsters? And it was actually a picture of me, you know, barefoot sitting in a modernist chair that appeared. And they said something about me and my, you know, intellectual disregard for shoes, which, you know, was fine as far as I can learn. Because the truth is, I don't wear shoes in my house. I don't. And they come to your house and they're like, oh, don't do a thing. We want to take pictures. You know, at that time, Dwell didn't really style. And they, you know, they didn't come in with somebody to make your house look perfect. So I thought, okay, I walk around barefoot. I'll just have my picture taken barefoot. But I guess, I don't know, most people I know, maybe it's because they have kids in New York, don't wear shoes in their house. So I never thought about that as an oddity.
You think most people don't wear shoes in their houses in New York?
People with kids, because they, you know, their kids are crawling around on the floor and they want to keep it as clean as it can
Interesting.
Be.
Okay. Most of the
maybe it's just my demographic.
Would you please self-identify, please?
Brooklyn parents.
There you go.
Yeah.
Locked in right there.
Right. Brooklyn parents. Well, yeah. And that,
well, I was wondering,
that opens up a can.
I was wondering whether Dwell is aimed at a Japanese audience for whom shoes in the house is like letting your dog relieve itself on the living room rug.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I can say that my lack of shoes in the pictures of me in my house was totally authentic, and I can't go much further than that.
Do you wear shoes in the house, Duo? Also, we're joined with Duo Dickinson.
We do. I mean, except when it's weather like this, and I must say that we had little kids, and I don't think we were ever barefoot, and I think that was because in Connecticut, it might be illegal to be in your house without your shoes on.
Well, see, then you're a different demographic.
I think you're exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter is two, and when she walks in the door of our house, she sits down on the floor, I mean, often like right in front of the door, and tries her hardest to get off her shoes and her socks herself. I mean, she'll struggle with them.
I have to ask a very personal question. Are you a Buddhist?
No.
Okay.
but I will tell you that Taunton Press, which is my press,
wrote a book
that was very successful called The Barefoot House. Yes. And it actually was quite well received.
I have often thought that they dwell, and there are, I mean, I can't say that I've seen a dwell house where people were not barefoot.
Now you're making me want to go through my back issues.
No, I mean, I happen to love shoes. I love shoes. I love hats. I love jackets. I love kilts.
You know, I just wrote a story for Dwell about the first passive house that's been completed in Brooklyn. That's going to be coming out in about a month.
I think you should check around before you say it's the first.
Okay.
Which one? The one in Red Hook?
No, it's in Park Slope. Okay.
Afterwards, I'll guide you to Ryan Enchity, who's been on the program five or six times. He's got a passive house, certified house in Red Hook.
Okay.
Which got flooded.
Oh.
It was passive house, but it wasn't flood resistant.
Well, it was very passive when it was confronted with water.
Yeah, and he's having a heck of a time getting flood water out of the super insulation on the lower level.
That's really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, an unintended consequence of super insulation.
Right.
Huh.
And he's and his client's house has got water trapped between the sheathing and 4 inches of XPS.
Oh, no.
And EFIS. Yeah, right. And I said, yeah, Ryan, it's XPS. It's not going to get all moldy. He said, yeah, but the water's going to eventually evaporate out, and it's going to cause the EFIS, which, for those of you who are interested, lay people, is exterior insulated finish system, which is basically it's polyester stucco. And it's going to cause the EFIS to bubble, and you know, it's going to be hell, and should we drill holes in it and put vents in it? And I said, yes. And jury's still out on that. I was going to go look at that passive house, except that you can't get there by subway, and I had no interest in taking my bike on the subway and then riding for like 8 miles. And I have eschewed owning a motor vehicle these last 2 years. I've become a Luddite duo.
Nothing wrong with that.
The bus works very well for Red Hook, though.
Okay, or take a bus, and so I took a pass. One last thing, because we're near to the end of our time, we've been speaking with Duo Dickinson and Alexander Lang, two good people. This is a good conversation. The number one, this is like Letterman list, number one, criticism of work as an implied endorsement to write about a project is perceived as an endorsement.
I think to write about a project is perceived as an endorsement of its importance. I think not always an endorsement of its quality. There's actually been an interesting debate on that point in the world of book reviewing recently, because a number of book reviewers said that if a book is just bad, they aren't going to write about it. They have limited space. Why talk about it? I think buildings are a little different, because there are plenty of bad buildings that are here forever, large presences in cities and towns. And so not to write about them would be sort of a glaring omission.
I'm totally with you on that. In fact, I've gotten into a lot of hot water locally, writing very negative reviews about some of the high modernist buildings here in New Haven, which were proved to be incredibly bad over time.
But in defense of Duo's work, Duo has designed and built some very large, very ambitious houses that have not gotten national press because they're not modern / Meccano, like Tom Kundig Olson projects in the Pacific Northwest, and nor are they tasteful modernist loft renovations in a city, but they're stylistically neo-traditional. Is that fair to say? Duo?
Well, yet there is this the one thing that
no, we your style. Can I call your style neo-traditional?
I don't know what it is, actually. It's one of these things where it's too traditional to be in any architecture magazine, and it's too wacky to be in any traditional house magazine. It's kind of biomorphic, kind of referential, but also the biggest thing is I don't want roofs to leak, so they're pitched, and that really screws me.
Well, I think of your work as carrying forward the spirit of craftsmen houses of green and green.
Yes, I agree with that.
All right, but that doesn't get any play.
Well, I feel like there are magazines for that I'm not reading, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean,
no, there are for very traditional, and this is something I've also written about. There is the greatest schism in design in America right now for architecture is there are two independent worlds. One is a traditional world that's for developers and decorators and sort of the typical shelter magazine, and there's the modern world, which is really for architects and their fans, and the two are completely disjointed, and the world that falls in between, which I and any number of architects that I know fall into, it doesn't exist anywhere. Right. In either camp, because I'm too weird to be in a traditional magazine and too traditional to be in an architecture magazine. So,
and judging by my friends, more people are where you are than they are in either of the other two camps. I mean, my house is very modern, and lots of people come there, and they're like, oh, this is great, but I wouldn't want to live in it.
Well, go to my website and write me a critique and tell me where I'm at. Because I would love it if somebody like you could actually say, you are this, because I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not that comfortable with labels, necessarily.
Me
but
either.
I was going to say, I mean, national press is one thing. Criticism, I mean, there's very little criticism of houses now. And I think for good reason, because
there aren't that many of them being built.
There aren't that many being built, and in general, they are for a rarefied audience. So
yep.
It doesn't make sense to put the critical resources in that area.
But in the blogosphere, as you said, there's unlimited space.
That's true. But for critique of houses, I don't know. It's interesting. I've been working on a piece that should come out soon about Mariana Griswold von Rensselaer, who was one of the first architecture critics in America and a woman at the turn of the century. And she wrote a lot about single-family houses and had a lot of interesting things to say.
What era was that?
1880s and 90s.
Griswold, like the Connecticut Griswold?
Yes.
Well, that's your neck of the woods. You got some research to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's like two towns over from you or something, right?
In fact, we helped renovate the Griswold Airport site.
All right. We're just about close to the end of our allotted time. Alexandra, do you have anything that you'd like to talk about that has not been brought up? Oh, you could plug your appearances again in Australia.
Yes, I will be in Australia the first week in March in Adelaide, March 6th, in Melbourne, March 7th, in Sydney, March 9th, and in Brisbane, March 11th.
Excellent. And Duo, do you have any Congress of Residential Architecture events coming up?
Well, not events, but I will tell you this. Everybody here could go to the CORA website. We're going to be sending out and register as a CORA recipient. We are going to be soliciting, and from you too, and for both of you probably, going to be soliciting ideas for the next big thing. And we have some interesting ideas. We might even have a sponsor, it looks like, a major sponsor that could actually fund an event. So anybody listening there that is anything to do with residential architecture, not necessarily an architect, but a critic or a designer or a builder, and you've got something that's burning within you to put in front of any number of people, just go to the CORA website and send us an email.
What's the URL for that?
It's CORA. It's www.coraarchitecture.org. C-O-R architecture.org.
All right. And to backtrack, the purpose of CORA is?
The Congress of Residential Architecture.
To promote?
Founded about 10 years ago with Jeremiah Eck, myself, and Dennis Wedlick, and we're trying to find the path for the future.
For single family or multiple dwelling housing or both or duo?
You dropped out there. Sorry.
Is it for only single family housing or multiple dwelling or?
Yeah, single family houses, not really housing, and budgets are very modest to very high. There's no elitist aspect to it. It's actually trying to get more houses for better people.
More single family houses.
Well, or projects which can in effect take the single family house into a different place.
That would be
excellent. More efficient and more green.
All right. This has been Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I am Curtis B. Wayne. We've been speaking with Alexander Lang, writer, thinker, mother, critic, and Duo Dickinson, architect and writer. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.